Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 369th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast, which is brought to you by Hulu and Neon, presenting Palm Springs, starring Andy Samberg, Kristen Milioti, and J.K. Simmons, for your consideration in all categories. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a multi-talented young actress who I, like many, have grown to adore. Over a decade in the business, she has made memorable impressions on TV series such as Shameless, Suburgatory, and What If, and in films including Evil Dead and Don't Breathe. But she has taken things to a whole different level as the lead of NBC's musical dramedy series Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, playing the title character who, while grappling with a personal tragedy at home, develops the ability to hear other people's innermost thoughts in the form of musical numbers, and also does some singing and dancing of her own. Jane Levy. Over the course of our conversation, the 31-year-old and I discuss her years-long journey to becoming an overnight sensation, the sorts of pressures and inappropriate behavior to which young actresses continue to be subjected, even in the Me Too era, what it's like being at the center of a show that is as grueling to make as Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist, the second season of which just began rolling out, and also why, at a time when musical theater is otherwise not available, the show is as important as ever, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Jane, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Great to have you. And always begin with just a few basics on this one. If you can share a little bit about where you were born and raised and what your folks did for a living.
I was born in Santa Monica, California. I moved...
Exotic.
Yeah. I moved to the Bay Area, though, when I was an infant. So I think I was 6 or 9 months old when my parents moved to Marin County, which is across the Golden Gate Bridge. My dad was a lawyer. He has since then transferred to doing mediation work. Mm-hmm. He does mostly environmental and human rights law. And my mother is a florist. She has a flower business with her sister. Her sister grows the flowers. It's all homegrown in Point Reyes. And my mom is the bouquet maker. She's
That's
the
awesome.
Arranger.
That's great.
Yeah, and they have a farmer's market in West Marin. And yeah.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. And siblings?
I have an older brother. He's 3 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And he is also a lawyer, and he lives in the East Bay with his wife and his baby.
So if people are catching on, there are a few strange parallels between you and Zoe, which we will come to, but just fun to realize that. So obviously curious to know when acting, forget about professional acting, but just performing of one sort or another first crossed the radar. I read that it may have started on the toilet. Is this?
Yeah. I mean, there are photographs of me as a very, very, very small child. Like, I would say 1 year old. I guess that's a baby. That's not a child. Where I'm, you know, I can't describe to you exactly how I was posing on this podcast, but you can see me right now. Like,
yes.
I've always been a performer, which is actually something I'm realizing in my older age is something that I was embarrassed of when I was, not as a kid, I was a kid, and so I just loved mm-hmm. performing in it, and I wanted attention, and, you know, I loved it. And then when I was a teenager and a young adult, I was kind of embarrassed by my need and desire and love for and of performing. But when I was little, I knew that acting was something that I wanted to do. And yes, I do. One of my earliest memories, I was sitting on the toilet. Don't know what I was doing on it. Could have been peeing, could have been pooping. I don't know. But I could have also just been sitting there because I was a child. And right. I remember calling to my mom in the kitchen with the door open. And I said, "Mom, can you get me an agent? Can we move to LA and can you get me an agent?" And I think she was just like, you know, what is she talking about? This is a kid.
How do you even know about that? You were like six?
Probably, maybe even four. I think it was pre-kindergarten. And my mom was like, "That's a kid talking nonsense." There's nobody in my family that is in the business. My mom was not a pushy mother in any way. Neither of my parents were, I don't know, what's the opposite of like a helicopter parent? They really let me have a lot of freedom and just be a kid. And there was no part of them that was ever like trying to shape me to be an athlete or a doctor or an actor. They were like, "Chill out, go outside." Yeah. So my mom didn't get me an agent.
Right, right. Now, what was or is, maybe it's still going on, Yes Theater?
Oh.
Is that something?
Oh my God. Whoa, you went deep. Whoa. You know what's so crazy is like, I don't even, okay, yes. That was, I think, the theater through my school, or it was through the Playhouse, which was the town playhouse. And my mom, I believe, actually illustrated the logo for Yes. Wow. Yeah, my mom did the logo for my elementary school. She did the logo for Ojai Valley School, where she went to high school, and my mom, or my brother went to high school. She did the logo for, I believe, Yes.
Okay. And so this was like essentially after school acting as a kid?
Yes.
And now there's a thing that's somebody associated with Yes has put online. I don't know if you've come across this, but they were very excited that you are an alumnus who has gone on to do good things. But basically they remembered you as, you know, an enthusiastic performer even as a kid. And I guess it seemed like you were really committed to this. And then something happened as you get into high school where you just like dropped it. What was that?
Do you know this person's name? Is there like...
I'm going to find it for you. Okay. I'm going to find it for you.
Yeah. And okay. So I was always like a precocious kid. I skipped a grade. I was always eager to do something else. School was boring to me. I was actually saying this to my friend last night, where I don't like the school setting. I don't like sitting in a classroom. I've learned, actually, being an actor, that I'm somebody who really needs to do something in order to learn it. And I have a lot of energy, and I'm impatient, and I'm not good at taking taking direction. If you're listening and you're a director, I'm really good at taking direction. No, I mean, like, as a kid, I just didn't want to be told what to do, you know? So in high school, I was like... you know, I was confused and I was angry and I was like screwing off and I was having fun. And I just, I don't know. I didn't have like a purpose, but I was like, I'm going to, although, you know, people are many things. And I would skip school, but I also got good grades, but I also was like hanging out with the bad kids, but I was also captain of the soccer team. When I say all this, I'm like, I sound so annoying.
No, this is interesting.
But yeah, I also didn't get along with my drama teacher. So David Smith, if you're listening, you gave me a B and I got an A in every other class except for drama, even though you cast me as Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. What was that about?
So up yours, David.
No, I'm sure he had like a good reason, you know, like maybe I was just a jerk and he was trying to, I don't know. Reform you. Yeah.
Yeah. But you weren't just a like member of the team. You were a good athlete, right? That was part of something that even continued into college.
Yes. I take everything that I do really seriously. And when I decide to do something, I commit to it like all the way. So with sports, it's like the most like clear cut way to commit to something. You know, you just like exercise and like try to be a good team member. And like, it's funny because I am naturally like competitive in a way that I think is probably like a healthy amount of competitive, I hope. But like, when I played soccer, I wasn't interested in winning. I was always interested in being the best that I could be and being the best teammate that I could be.
Well, so just to geographically situate people at this point, when you're in high school, you're still on the West Coast, right? Now
yes.
You get into college very far away.
Yes.
Baltimore, I believe, Goucher. And
yes.
Go off there. And it sounds like it was not a good fit. What happened?
No. Okay. So first of all, I just want to say I'm like massively impressed by you as an interviewer. Like the research and the thought, like this is, I'm impressed.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I didn't get into like any schools that I thought were like interesting. I didn't want to go to college. When I was a junior in high school, I went to England for 6 months because, like I said, I was just searching for something that wasn't in school. And I love experiences. And I guess I was searching for some experience that was going to make me feel like alive. And I always felt like when I was doing what everyone else was doing, like I was really bored and I just felt like deadened. And I think this is all sort of why I love acting. It's like it's an experiential art form. So when I was graduating from high school, I was 17 and I was like, I don't even want to go. I don't know what I want to study. I don't like school. Can I take a year off? And my parents were really like, you should go to college. Like, what else are you going to do? And I was like, you're right. I didn't get into like any schools. I think I was waitlisted at Sarah Lawrence and then they let me in. And then I visited Sarah Lawrence and I was like, I don't know if this is for me. And I just ended up going to Goucher because they were like, play on the soccer team here. And it was something that I knew and it was something that I had been working hard on. And so I went and I was a jock. I worked out twice a day. I hung out with all the jocks, like truly like doing deadlifts in the morning and like sprinting up and down stairs at night. And like I could do 75 pushups in a minute and a half, like,
oh
like crazy athlete person.
Yeah.
And I was massively depressed. I actually went on antidepressants in college. I became an insomniac. I was going through some personal stuff also, but I just was like, this makes me feel terrible. I don't even know why I'm in Maryland. I'm not connected to anything that I'm doing. And that was when that summer, after my freshman year, I planned a trip to Europe with a girlfriend because some of my friends had done that in high school or between high school and college. And I was like, they all looked like they had fun on Facebook. I'm going to try that. So I went to Europe and it sounds cheesy, but I do remember being on a train and journaling and being like, what is it that does make me happy? Because mm-hmm. I had a really rough year, my first year in college. And By the way, I hope when I just said I went on antidepressants, I hope that didn't sound like it was a shameful thing. I think antidepressants are a wonderful tool.
It's come up actually in our last episode as well.
Okay.
You're in good company. Ben
Okay, Affleck good. Yeah. God bless antidepressants. Yep. I'm going to write a pop song sometime that's a love song to them. So I was in Europe and I was like, what is it that makes me happy? And I, like I've said before, there was always this like embarrassment or shame or like, there was something about acting that I like hid for so many years. Like I always knew that I could do it. Like I was like, if I really want to do that thing, I know I can do it. I just know there's something in me that but I was embarrassed or ashamed. I don't know. Maybe this is something I need to bring up with my therapist, but so I was writing my journal on the train from one country to another. Romantic, cheesy, whatever you want to call this story. And I was like, I love acting so much. And I'm 18 years old. Why not try it? You know, like if I fail in 2 years, 4 years, five, like fine, I can still go back to school. But like, you know, shouldn't I at least try? And then I came home from the trip and I was like, Mom, Dad, I'm dropping out of college. And they were like, okay.
I was going to ask how that conversation goes. Yeah.
And they were like, what are you going to do instead? And I was like, I'm going to go be an actress. And they were like, okay. And, you know, I don't think there's any part of them that thought that that was an actual possibility. I think that they just saw an 18-year-old kid who wants to be an actress. There's so many of those. And I was like, but I'm not going to move to LA because strategically, I don't think that makes sense. I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to apply to acting schools. So I went on the internet and found all the acting schools I could and auditioned for all of them. And I believe I got into most, if not all of them. And I ended up going to Stella Adler. And my time there, I just, like, everything inside of me opened up. And I was so, so happy. And, like, that depression that I had was gone. And I was in New York City, and I was, like, you know, out in the world. And I think the thing that I love the most about it and the thing that, like, just really fills me up is the experience. Like, just, you know, it's about experiencing joy and heartbreak and all the extremes of life with other people. Like, you know, we were in movement class and we'd all have to dress in black. And our teacher was this very strict former ballet dancer. And she'd make us get on the floor and roll around and bark like dogs and do Shakespeare while we were doing it. And it was just so fun to be in this group of like-minded freaks who were willing to feel things, for lack of a better way to put it.
This, I mean, for people who don't know, I mean, this place has great history, like Brando, Marilyn Monroe, a lot of great people came through there. I think you were doing it in the evenings. Is that right? Like the evenings. So what do you do during the day then? Do you have are you waitressing? Like what do you do the rest of the time?
You know, I think the only reason I did it during the evening is because I took 6 months off after I dropped out of college and nannied at home and was trying to figure out which school I was going to go to. And so I started my program in January, and the only program at that school that started in January was the Evening Conservatory. So I was like, I just want to start right away. Let's do that. And it was designed for people who have other careers or jobs and, you know, want to go to acting school as well. I actually got a job at the studio, and I would like stock the bathrooms with toilet paper.
For you, those, you know, I guess you were only there, it's like a 2-year program. What's the biggest takeaway as you look back now, having seen what you actually use in the real world? Like, what was the greatest value of having been there?
My biggest takeaway, one of their mottos is awareness without judgment, which is very like Zen. And it's about looking at things the way that they are. And if you know how things are, you can then play a character who has an actual just like opinion about things or a point of view. But before that, you sort of just have to know things like you have to see things objectively. And that was a really valuable piece of practice, I don't know, that I learned from Stella Adler. Also, for me, it was just the love of the craft. Like, I still go to class. I now take class with a teacher named Tony Greco, who teaches the method. The method is different than what I originally thought, but I am, like, so obsessed with acting, and I think that there's never, there's just so much to learn forever. And, you know, the other thing about, like, going to Stella Adler or going to this class that I go to, any class that you go to, you really have to look at yourself and examine yourself before you're able to play other characters. And I think that's a really valuable thing to do in order to be like a good citizen or friend or girlfriend or, you know.
All right. So age 20, you're done there, and you now have to kind of make a decision where you go with this. The fact that you then move to LA basically suggests that it was not, you know, you're not thinking like, let's see if I can primarily work in theater. You knew that you wanted to do screen acting?
Yeah, so I had a boyfriend at the time who wanted to move to California. So the move was partially because he wanted to do that, so I was going to follow him there. Mm-hmm. But also, yeah, I think instinctively, I've always thought of myself as more of a person that makes sense on screen than on stage.
Why do you think so?
Okay, I have this superpower where I'm really photogenic. Like, I'm so much better looking on camera than I am in real life. It's true. Like, something about the camera just makes me pretty. And I, you know, I've often had people look at me and be like, oh yeah, you're that person. I mean, and I can tell, like, it's like, yeah, I know. I don't look like I do on camera. It's just a lucky thing about my bone structure, probably. I'm a real ugly person in real life, and I look like a TV star on camera.
Well, okay, so whatever it was, you're working pretty quickly once you're back in LA, because I guess the first thing of any, like, note would have been this recurring part on Shameless, right? This is 2011, the 6 episodes of the first season of the show. How big a deal was it to even just get hired?
It was a really big deal. I mean, I think because when I got out of acting school, I was 19, I was 20, but I looked really young. And so I was a baby, in my opinion. Now I'm like, Jesus, I was so young, with a conservatory training background. So I feel like that was sort of like a rare thing, you know, especially someone who's auditioning for like ABC and is auditioning to play a teenager, didn't necessarily go to conservatory. So maybe I had a leg up there. And I actually, the first job I ever booked was very shortly after I started auditioning. I sent out my headshot and our packet, whatever resume. I don't know what the hell was on my resume because I had never worked before, but I like made up, I probably put in yes, theater, you know. I got a manager while I was still at Stella Adler because I had a very good headshot. And he brought me in just on my headshot, and he started sending me auditions, and I booked a job within a month, and it was to play Melanie Lynskey's daughter in an indie film who I've now worked with twice, and she's become a great friend of mine, and I admire her so much on every level, but especially as an actress. She's so incredible. It also makes no sense that I would play her daughter because I'm like 12 years younger than her, but that's Hollywood. And I was, like I said, I looked really young. Anyways, right. I didn't have to end up doing that job because I got Shameless. And I remember John Levy's the casting director for Shameless, and, you know, thank
no
you.
Relation.
No relation, but thank you for giving me my career. And I remember I came in for Shameless, and he was like, go home and, like, you look too wholesome. I think he said something like, you look like you could be on the cover of a cereal box or something. And he was like, go home, put on some, like, dirtier clothes, like, fuck up your hair, put on more makeup, and come back. And I remember I was like, okay. And I went home, and I, like, I wore my boyfriend's sweatshirt at the time with like a bra underneath and was like, I'm going to unzip this and I'm just going to be wearing my bra. And I like put on a bunch of eyeliner and like I came back in and on the drive home, which I was living on Fraternity Row in Westwood because that was the only sublet I could find, in my mom's Volvo, lying to her that I wasn't living with my boyfriend, but I was on Fraternity Row in some like college kid's dorm room. I was driving home after the audition and my agents called me and I got the job and I crashed my car.
What? Actually?
Yeah. I mean, I hit a pole, but I was like, so to answer your question, was it a big deal? Yes, it was a huge deal.
Well, and also we should say, just people have to imagine what we're, you know, this is all kind of pictures in their head as they're listening here. You did not look the way you look now when you were going into that job, right?
Yeah, I mean, I had short blonde hair. And I remember Laura Wiggins was on the show and they were like, you look too much like her. And then I think that job is the reason why I have red hair, because they dyed my hair blackish red and then it started to wash out. And when I was working on that show still, I went on my audition for Suburgatory and I was like, oh, I'm trying to get my hair slowly back to blonde. And they were like, no, keep it red.
Okay. So, and you felt good about that? I mean, it's one of these things about the business where it's like, that's not an uncommon kind of thing. I think people assume you're always been redhead. Was it something that was tough to give up being blonde?
No, I honestly don't care about hair. Like, yeah. put it something fake on there, shave it off, cut it. I don't care.
Okay, so why after just that first season of Shameless did you depart?
Because I got the role of Tessa Altman on the ABC sitcom Suburgatory.
Which ABC Wednesday nights, this is a big deal. It's a first leading part that you would have had, of course. And just to familiarize people, you're playing this sort of snarky teen who is compelled by her dad to leave the big city and move to the suburbs. And this was a part that was going to ask a lot more of you than any professional gig you'd had yet. When you sign up for a network show like that, just tell people what that actually means, what you're signing away, what you're going to now have to do.
So, yeah, it was a really big deal for me. I mean, Shameless was the first time I'd ever seen a movie set. It's not like I had even been an extra for fun when I was a kid. Like, I've never seen a soundstage. I'd never stepped on a set until my first day on Shameless. So this was only 6 months later. And, you know, I think because I was so young and inexperienced and naive, it sort of worked in my favor because I didn't realize at the time what a big deal it was. The testing process was super extensive. I went in to the casting director. Oh my God, I just remembered how I got this. I went in for a general meeting at ABC and the person I was supposed to meet, I don't know who you are out there, I don't remember, was like, I didn't have a meeting with her. And then this woman was like, come into my office, you can talk to me. And I went and talked to her and I was wearing Fry boots and she was like, you know what? There's this script about this girl wears motorcycle boots. Can you read it right now? And she handed me the script. This sounds like I'm making this up. Like, I'm going to tell this story when I'm a grandma and my kids are going to be like, she's lying. But she gave me the script. I read Suburgatory right then and there and read for her. She's not a casting director. It wasn't an audition. It was supposed to be a general meeting. I read the lines and she was like, I'm going to set you up with an audition for this part. I'm going to find out who this person's name is and tell you before.
Yeah, please.
We can give her credit. But anyways, I auditioned many times. I auditioned for Emily Kapnick, the creator. Then the testing process where you go, like I went to Warner Brothers and Peter Roth and many other executives, like you go into their office. All the girls are lined up outside. You've already signed your deal. So that was the first time I'd ever really like learned about that, which is like, here's a 6-year contract.
Well, what you mean
contract.
Is you've signed the deal that if they want you, you're on the hook now.
Yes.
There's no backing out.
Yes. Oh,
for
and also,
7 years?
Also, yes. I remember right before this, also, I had tested for an Alan Ball pilot. He made a show called All Signs of Death, or a pilot of All Signs of Death. And I had just tested for that, and I didn't get the part, and I was devastated. And so I go into this. So this was my second test deal, probably. I go and I sign the contract, I probably 6 or 7 years. I got paid diddly squat, which I at the time was so much money, and I'm so proud. But like, I look back, whatever. I shouldn't say that. It wasn't diddly squat. It was a lot of money. I'm so grateful. And anyways, I found out I got the part, and I remember being silent on the phone, and my agents were like, Jane, you're allowed to be excited. Like, this is a big deal. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, great. I'm so excited. And then I look back and I'm just like so grateful for Emily Kapnick. Like, I feel it was so cool.
But wait, so your kind of muted reaction was not getting that it was a big deal, or what was that about?
I guess, yeah, I think it was not getting what a big deal it was.
Mm-hmm. So the person who you were just starting to talk about when I interrupted you, I apologize, is the showrunner of that show, Emily Kapnick. And you have said that one of the things that made that a very positive experience, that show for you, was the fact that she was running it. There's sort of that it's not just a woman, but a feminist and somebody who's approaching things in a way that, from what I gather, has not always been the case on things that you've worked on. So talk about just that and how the person at the top can really set the tone for the whole show.
Yeah, she is so talented. I look back at that show and I remember just so many funny lines and what a cast she brought together. I remember at the time doing interviews with like Liz Merriweather and Zooey Deschanel and me and Emily, and them asking me questions about what it means to be on a show and being the lead as a woman and having a showrunner as a woman, and really being an infant in terms of like knowing about feminism and in this industry, like just being so unaware of the misogyny. And I didn't know. I remember being like, I don't know what to say. And now I look back and I'm like, wow. That there's so many reasons why that show was cool. I mean, I just, you know, I grew up with a mother who never taught me, not even consciously, I don't think, that my value as a woman is what I like look like. I just, that was never something that was ingrained in me. And I feel like Emily was the same, where it wasn't like, let's make this show to show everyone that girls can lead a show and can be funny and don't have to be super skinny. It was just like, of course, that's the case, you know? But that is radical. And she did find me out of, like, you know, a bunch of girls with a lot of TV career. Like, I remember the girl who tested against me has this big TV career, and she picked me. And I just feel like I owe her a lot, basically, is what I'm trying to get at. Thank you. Thank you, Emily.
Well, so you had 3 great seasons, 57 episodes. You described it as really, you know, a pivotal time because, you know, you get some experience, you get visibility in the business. People are now thinking of you in terms of being a lead on things. So when May 9th, 2014 comes along and the network pulls the plug on the show, was that a surprise for you? How did you take that? Did you think like, there goes my shot?
It wasn't a surprise, because when they picked us up for a third season, they picked us up for half order. And that was sort of an indicator that, you know, maybe the show wasn't doing as well in terms of viewership. I know that things have changed massively since then. And now it's less about those Nielsen numbers, I think. But I was working on Monster Trucks, actually. I was in Vancouver, where I am now, when I got the phone call from Emily. And I sort of knew it was coming. And I was sad to say goodbye. But, you know, 3 seasons of a TV show is a success, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. And probably the right length most of the time. These things go on too long, I think.
Yeah.
All right. So it was, I guess, another thing that probably made you feel not, you know, despondent or whatever when your show is ended, is that during the run, I guess during your off seasons, you had started to do more movies, including the first of the two most kind of notable ones, I guess, which both happen to be from the horror genre and both happen to be directed by the same person. And so I wonder if you can just tell us about how that, you know, all came about in the first place. I mean, horror is a kind of specific skill set. I've had actually people, you know, come on this podcast and say, you know, people poo-poo my early roles in horror because they think it's just silly. But to make a movie like that work is actually more demanding than a lot of other things for actors. So anyway, I just wonder, first, 2013 is the reimagining of Evil Dead, and then 2016 is Don't Breathe, both of which had a lot of skeptical people going in and then had a lot of people that really liked them. So just how that came about with the same director and what that's like for you.
Yeah, I mean, my coach always likes to say this story, which I don't know if it's true or not, but it's about this pandemic really has my brain turning into nothingness. Like, I'm just about to say something all the time, and I'm like, do I have a brain anymore? What's her name from Ghostbusters, from freaking Alien?
Sigourney Weaver?
Okay, supposedly Sigourney Weaver was out of acting school and she was an incredibly trained actor. She went to Juilliard or something, right?
Yale. Yeah.
She went to Yale and she got this B-movie script of Alien and she made, like, but she studied Macbeth, so she made her part, like, she made Macbeth, whatever. She used Macbeth as, like, the starting point for Alien, and she's incredible, and I admire her so much, even though I can't remember her name, but it has nothing to do with her. It has to do with my my problems. Right. So when I was finishing season one of Suburgatory, I read that they were making the remake of Evil Dead, and I believe I wrote to my agents, and I said, can I be in this movie? Because I thought it would be fun. Like, there was something, like, I have a perverted sense of humor, and I guess I like scary movies. I didn't really realize that until I was, like, in them, and people were like, do you like them? And I was like, yeah, I guess I really do. So I remember writing to my agents, and they were like, the lead's already cast. It's Lily Collins. And I was like, I don't care. I'll play another part. And they were like, okay. And then they were like, oh, guess what? Lily Collins dropped out. And they're looking for a new lead. And I was like, okay, can I audition? And they were like, yeah, here's your audition. And I remember reading it and being like, wow, this is going to be so fun. Like, what a ridiculous thing. And also so different than what I've been doing. Like, I want to play. And so I went to the audition and I got the part. Mm-hmm. And I went to New Zealand and I shot the movie. And it was a really terrible experience. And I remember talking to one of our producers, Rob Tapper, who produced the originals with Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell, and he was like, yeah, it's miserable. Like, I've talked about it a lot, but physically and emotionally, psychologically, it takes a toll when every day you're covered in prosthetics, in the rain, freezing cold, screaming and crying for your life, getting buried alive, chopping your tongue in half, ripping your arm off. Right. It was awful. But I'm proud of it.
Yeah. I mean, it opened at South by Southwest. People went in there saying, you know, how dare you have a female lead instead of the male character? And meanwhile, came away really into it.
Yeah.
So that was the first one.
Yeah.
And then the same director, you're back with 3 years later for Don't Breathe.
Yeah, so he called me 2 weeks before shooting was supposed to start, or 3 weeks before shooting was supposed to start, and said, hey, like, I'm trying to make this movie. I can't find the lead actress. And people loved you in Evil Dead. I loved your performance. Come do this again with me. And I was like, okay. And I got on a plane and went to Budapest and shot the movie 3 weeks later.
Wow.
Wow. And hopefully a little less grueling experience. But
yeah. I mean, have you seen it?
I have not seen Don't Breathe. Okay. I did see Evil Dead. Yeah.
Well, there's a pretty terrible thing that happens in that movie, but we don't have to go there.
well, just now you've piqued my curiosity. You don't have to get into detail, but like, what you get, something happens to your character?
Maybe you know. I mean, it's just like every time I tell this story, I'm like, I can't believe this is my life. That this is something that I said yes to. I was hung up. Side down in a harness in a basement and my pants are cut, and then he attempts to inseminate me with a turkey baster full of his semen.
Jesus. Did you know that was in the script when you sign up? Hey, you know, well, so I'm getting we're getting a nod a nod. Yes.
Yep.
Hey, you know,
this is my legacy, Scott.
Listen, I will have to catch up with that one, I guess. But no, okay. So
my aunt took my 90-something-year-old grandmother to see that movie.
Ooh.
Yep, but she loved it, supposedly.
I will get back to you on that. So okay. All right. So that was 2016, 2017. We're making our way to the present, but it's just interesting. Like even some of the things that don't pan out. For instance, there's I believe you did a pilot for Amazon with Glenn Close. You and she are like the two stars, called Sea Oak, and it didn't get picked up.
Not only with Glenn Close, it was written by George Saunders and directed by Hiro Murai. And if people listening don't know who George Saunders is, he's like one of the greatest living authors, arguably. He has like the Booker T Award, what's it called? Dumb actress knows literary awards, not.
No, okay.
He wrote, Lincoln in the Bardo, that was his first novel, mostly wrote short stories. Hiro directs for Atlanta, and he's done many music videos, and he, what's the movie he made with Rihanna? And
yeah, the Guava
Something
Island,
right? Something bad has to happen to me because I didn't know. my brain. Okay. Anyways, it was. And by the way, not only am I working with Glenn Close, dies a virgin. She's my Aunt Bernie, and she dies a virgin at age 60, 70, whatever, and crawls back from her grave because she's like, fuck this, I'm going to get laid. And she has these, like, idiotic nieces and nephews that live with her, me, Jack Quaid, and Ray Gray. Ray and I have babies, and Jack works as like a, he sort of is like a, he works at like a peep show where like, mm-hmm. It's hard to explain. Anyways, she comes crawling back from the dead to be like, fuck you motherfuckers, shape up and get me laid. And like, there's a scene with like Glenn Close like spitting her teeth and dirt on the floor, screaming at, I'm going to talk to Jack tomorrow. And I was like, I was going to say, do you remember working with Glenn Close? Like, do you remember her as a zombie screaming at us? I think it's the coolest thing I've ever made. And it didn't get picked up and nobody saw it.
Were you surprised it didn't get picked up, or did you think it was going to be a tough sell?
Well, supposedly, I hope this is true and I'm not just like making things up, but I think it was the most expensive half-hour comedy Amazon had ever made.
Wow.
And I think it might have been too weird to spend that much money on it.
Yeah.
But damn.
That would have been interesting. Would have probably precluded some of the other things we're going to come to. So, you know, the alternate history. But the other thing that year was an episode of Twin Peaks, which has its own kind of cult following and interesting group of people, I would think.
Yeah, I'm a massive fan of the series, of David Lynch. I made the self-tape I made was when I was in Budapest shooting Don't Breathe, and all you're supposed to do, like, I guess either you go into the casting director and you have a conversation with her and they film it, or you just tape yourself talking. So I just made a tape of myself talking about my favorite movies. And I got a response that was like, they like you, there's a pin in you. And then 7 or 8 months later, I got a phone call when I was eating Indian food. And they were like, do you want to be on Twin Peaks tomorrow? And I was like, uh-huh, what? And they were like, do you want to be on Twin Peaks tomorrow? And I was like, yeah. And my agents were like, we can't guarantee you're even going to have a line. And I was like, I don't fucking care.
Yeah, it's Twin Peaks. Yeah.
I have one line, by the way.
Hey, you know what? It's, I think it was, they, you know, there's this thing lately, and it's happened again for 2020 with like Small Axe, the Steve McQueen thing, where it's technically a TV thing, but it's showing up on top 10 lists of best movies. And Twin Peaks was everywhere in that year. But anyway, the last pre-Zoe thing we got to talk about is What If, which another amazing thing where it's you and a great actress, Renee Zellweger. When you're at work, are you able to sort of, whether it's Glenn Close or Renee Zellweger or whoever, are you able to kind of process and retain things that they're doing that maybe you could apply? Or is it just sort of you're so in the moment with what you've got to do that it's hard to do that?
When it comes to like acting, I'm not sure that I am like, oh, that's amazing acting and I'm going to try that. Like, it's like, but more like how they act as like people on set. And like Glenn Close, like even her dead body getting carried away in a stretcher was her. When she falls down these steps in the beginning, that was her. And I was like, oh, wow. Like, that's someone who's just really loves the process still, you know, and is like very available to her crew and her director and her castmates. And I really admired that in her. I was terrified of her, to be honest. I mean, she was supposed to be terrifying to me. And also, I'm just like, holy shit, you're Glenn Close. With Renee as well, like, she has no pretension. She drives a minivan. She doesn't have an assistant or a team. She would just sort of like float in and out of set. And like, I have a problem where I get like, I sometimes get overwhelmed with everything happening off screen that I'm like, where's my energy to like, I'm so worried about relationships and like making sure everything's in order that like, I'm like, oh God, the most important thing is like getting everything on camera. Like, but there, you know, you start working with people for so many hours a day, they become sort of like your family and like everyone starts eating each other's shit. Anyways, I was really impressed by Renee Zellweger as like a movie star. She was just so kind. She also was very present when she needed to be, but she definitely had like boundaries that I just respected. I was like, oh, okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Take a note.
So the other thing that I'm going to just bring up in relation to this, because you have mentioned it and it's got some pickup and I think it's maybe valuable for young people in the business to just be aware of. We talked about a very positive, you know, the value of maybe a feminist feeling set with Emily Kapnick. Then there was an experience, keeping in mind, I believe this is all like post Me Too and all the things that are supposed to have made our industry better and friendlier and more aware and all that. You recently commented about something that happened there where it did not feel that way.
Yeah. I tweeted that because I was supporting my friend Samantha Ware, who was on the show, when she was talking about microaggressions on set and her experience. She was talking about a different show and people were criticizing her, scrutinizing what she said. And so the reason I tweeted what I tweeted, which was this experience I had and that Samantha came to my aid, was just in support of her. But I also feel like it's important to share these experiences because they make actresses feel less alone or less gaslit and crazy when sexist, misogynistic things happen to them. And, you know, even I remember listening to an interview with Jennifer Lawrence and something that she said a woman producer did to her. And it was so helpful for me because this experience that I tweeted about is just one of many terrible things that have happened to me in this business. And
really already, even being as relatively new to it in the sense that like your career is essentially the past decade still. I mean, that's, I know you've done a lot and all of that, but you would think, you know, it's not the bad old 90s or whatever when certain things, you know, like people might think this is like way in the past and the stuff that you're, the one incident that you did talk about was a director being I don't know how to characterize it. I don't know if you want to characterize it, but basically,
I guess it's like you could say it's harassment. I don't know. His name is Philip Noyce. He directed most of our show, or the first three episodes or something. We were in a camera test, and I walked out in a dress, and he screamed in front of everybody, like, not even to me. Like, I don't know who he was talking to. Like, why do her breasts look so small? You know, usually, and I think he said something like, usually she has such a beautiful figure, which was supposed to be, like, a way to either, like, compliment me and sort of, like, downplay what he had just said by, like, but I'm like, I don't want that compliment either. And so he was like, can somebody get her a padded bra? You know, it's like one thing to maybe aside, say, to the costume director, which I still actually think would probably be inappropriate. But, you know, directors, it's a visual medium and directors want what they want. But for him to yell about my body like that was like mortifying. And so I walked off set, put on a padded bra, came back, and he was like, much better. And I like walked to my seat, and I remember Samantha being like, are you okay? And at the time, I was like, it's not that big of a deal. But then I went into my trailer and I like cried for like so hard. And I remember being like, it's not that big of a deal. But then convincing myself that even though it was really hurtful and embarrassing and shameful and like all of the things, like it just made me feel also like that's not a way to set up an environment where someone can be a great actor, you know, because acting is about being vulnerable and knowing you have to know that you're safe. And anyways, there's
but you're
been,
saying you've had a lot of things like that.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I've had like and I've it's only recently that I've realized like how bad it is, you know. And it's like I just said, it's just like a such a stupid way to behave, because if you want to make something good, you know, that idea of like harassing actresses and so that they're good at horror films is like so insulting, so juvenile, and like so untrue. I think the way to make great stuff is to make people feel like protected and safe, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, I'm sorry you've had to deal with all that.
I mean, yeah.
Hopefully people are, you know, the thing that I guess we're seeing in the broader society this week after whatever happened like a week and a day ago is the best deterrent of bad behavior is maybe to just call out and embarrass the people who do it. And then,
it's interesting. I actually just tweeted this morning. I was listening to Brené Brown's podcast, and she was talking about shame, and she was talking about accountability. And like, I really liked what she was saying, because we can shame people, but that might actually not fix the problem. Most likely that's not going to fix anything. You know, these people are already full of shame. When you act a way that's like abusive, it's probably because you're suffering shame. But it is really important to hold ourselves and to hold others accountable. You know, like I've been so angry in my life that all I want to do is like shame people. But done that. I'm not saying I listen to this podcast and this is who I am. I just was like listening to it, and I was like, oh, I want to practice that, because I do want the world to be better. I do want, you know, I don't, you know, cancel culture is flawed. I don't think that we should, it's important, and it's the result of like the imbalance of power and the abuses that have gone on forever. But I don't think that the end goal is to just cancel people so that they right. can never exist anymore. Like I would love it if people could take accountability and like suffer consequences for actions, but be able to like change, you know, and yeah. be better and have a second chance or whatever. Like,
yeah.
So me it's saying Philip's one. Voice is, or name is not necessarily for me to be like, burn Philip. But I do think it's important to, and by the way, when I tweeted that, Warner Brothers took it very seriously, and like people contacted me, and I don't want to press charges. Like, I don't think he deserves to go to jail or never work again. But I do think that he should be held accountable for saying something that's so unprofessional, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you wouldn't go into your tax accountant's office and say something like, I hope, maybe he would.
Right.
All right. Anyway, right. So it is pilot season 2019. You are now, I guess, open for work because What If was going to be a limited thing. And how do you first hear about this project that has become Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist?
It's another experience where I read about it. I remember reading that the show was picked up and Paul Feig was originally supposed to direct it. And I remember taking note of it. And I actually want to search in my emails because I think I might have written to my agents about it. And then they just came to me in the end of January 2019 and said, we have an offer on a show that we think you'll probably like. And
a straight up offer or an offer to audition or what was the...
A straight up offer. I had just done What If, which is like a melodrama. And I was really excited about the idea of like a joyful project and a comedy. Like I like doing comedy.
Well, I guess maybe before we go any further, if you wouldn't mind setting up, let's pretend that somebody's listening to this who hasn't watched any of the show yet. Can you just give like a little tease of what the show deals with and also why it's so personal for the guy who hired you, Austin Winsberg, who's the showrunner and has his own connection to the subject matter?
You know, it's funny. Every time I start to give a synopsis of the show, I think to myself, okay, this time I'm going to make it real tight. I'm going to make it make a lot of sense. And then I always end up rambling, but I'll try.
You do whatever you want to do.
Okay. Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist is about a young woman named Zoe, played by me, who is a coder in San Francisco. And when we meet her, she has a father that is suffering from a rare neurological condition called progressive supranuclear palsy. And I guess the easiest way to describe it is kind of like Lou Gehrig's. Your brain and muscles deteriorate and eventually you're not able to speak or move or like breathe, swallow. So we meet her and she's suffering some headaches. So she goes to get an MRI because she's worried, I don't know, maybe this is a genetic condition. I don't want to have what my dad has. And while she's in the MRI, there's an earthquake in San Francisco. And when she leaves the doctor's office, she starts walking down the street and she can suddenly hear people singing to her. And then she slowly realizes that they're not singing out loud. She's the only one that can hear it. And she's actually reading their minds. But instead of them talking to her, she reads their minds through song and dance numbers. That was pretty quick.
That's great. And I think it really does also capture the fact that there is a lot of, you know, it deals with serious, you know, sometimes heavy stuff, but in a way that is still fun and joyful and with a point. So, and the reason that it exists is because Austin's had his own version of this, right?
Yeah, our showrunner, Austin Winsberg's father, passed away a few years ago from this condition. And when he was losing his father, he thought, like, what if... Like, the hard part about this is that you can't communicate with your loved one, you know? And I think that's what's so beautiful about our story is that you watch Zoe be able to connect with her father again through this superpower. And that's where Austin got this idea, through the tragedy that happened in his life.
So what do you think it was? You've kind of talked about the fact that when you met Austin, who was giving you this straight up offer for the part, he didn't seem to really know much about you or your background. And yet he's entrusting his whole, at that point, I guess, pilot to you. How do you figure that out?
Yeah, I make fun of him and our producer sometimes because I remember that meal. And I remember being like, yeah, I just wrapped this show on Netflix. And they were like, oh, really? And I'm like, yeah, like, isn't that why you hired me? Like, Renee Zellweger was in it. And they're like, oh, wow, that's cool. And I'm like, okay, but why do you want me? You know, right. And I'm sure that I just am on this list. I mean, I've already led a network show. And like Austin says, this part had to check boxes. And I have sung in projects before, so he knows I can sing. Not sure
you
if I can.
You sung in which?
I sang in Suburgatory, but I also was in this very bizarre independent movie called Bang Bang Baby that went to TIFF in 2014. So there's recordings of me singing. I can carry a tune. He knows I can do that. He knows I can do comedy. And I guess he knew I could do drama. I don't know. I don't know how he knew these things, but he knew.
Well, and you danced, I guess, as a kid.
Yes.
Right.
But the thing is, at the beginning, it was unclear how much Zoe was going to partake, but he knew he needed... Every time someone auditions for the show, he makes sure that they can sing at least a little bit. And so in my mind, I think that I was just on some list, you know, like those lists exist that studios are like, we're down to hire this person. And I think on all sides, it's just been like, beshert is the Yiddish word, right? it's kismet. I didn't really know that the show was going to be what it was. I don't think Austin really knew that I had the abilities that I ended up being able to do, like, an episode. Like, we...
Did you have any doubt that you would be able to...
Yes.
...carry this? You did?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I was scared. I'm, you know, it's a lot of responsibility, and I care a lot. So, yes and no. Like, I think there's part of me that's like, absolutely, of course, I know I can do this, and then there's part of me that's like, no, you can't. No, you can't run away. No, you can't. But it's just been such a pleasure for me, like, because I had no idea when I signed on that the show was going to be what it is. Like, it's a collaboration between the rest of the cast and the songs that we borrow and the choreography and the cinematography and the directors and the writing. It's like a beautiful collaboration that really worked. You know, when I've said this before, but when I read the script and I was like, I remember texting Mae Whitman, who's my best friend, and I was like, you know, this... scene where he sings True Colors, like, I don't think I can handle some strange man singing that to me. Like, I'm cringing right now, you know? And then when I made it, it's like one of the most pivotal scenes, I think, in the series, especially because it's in the pilot. And, you know, there is something about our show that is like radically earnest. And I think that, you know, my judgmental self could sometimes be like, oh, this is cheesy. But I think my response by calling something cheesy is just actually embarrassment about how much it actually affects me. And what's really special about our show is we just lean into that, you know? And it's like, we allow I feel like while watching our show, you can laugh, you can cry, you can cringe, you can swoon, you can dream. Like, but we don't lean away from the sincerity, which... You know, I guess like Austin talks about the tone, like 1 degree this way, it could be extra cheesy. 1 degree this way, it could be flat. And it's something that I'm proud of as a group, that like people's genuine, vulnerable hearts are put into this show. And I think that's why it's affecting.
Well, and it's, I think people should also know how hard you guys work, in the sense that season one, I believe, mostly was in Canada, somewhat in San Fran, but 6 months to make one season, is that right? And just like, you're the lead, you're not only the lead of a show, which you've been before, but you're the lead of a show where you're gonna be involved with every scene. I mean, if other people are singing or dancing, it's because your character's involved and imagining it, but then you have your own that you do. And I guess I just wonder if you can break down for people what just physically that's like, generally, to be doing something over 6 months, but specifically, let's take a musical number that you pick one. Like, what's the process from start to finish of turning something around?
Yeah. Okay. So it's a lot of work. I mean, most shows that are an hour long get 8 days to shoot. We get 8 days to shoot, yet we have to do 6 musical numbers in there as well. And I last year was in practically every single scene. Besides just being on camera, like, I have to go to fittings, I have to do ADR, I have to record the music, I have to rehearse, I have to get my hair cut, I have to get my hair dyed, I have to get my extensions put in. I have, like, there's so much I have to do outside of work. Like, I was just like bursting last year. It was like every minute of my whole life for 6 months was Zoe's, like weekends, everything. It was very time consuming. And then for Mandy, she has to choreograph and put up 6 numbers every episode. It's like, it's a lot of work. So like, for example, episode 8, my character performed every single number.
This is Zoe's Extraordinary Glitch, where basically, I don't want to give anything away, but yeah, I mean, 7 numbers, right, for one episode?
I think six or so.
Okay.
And so for me, we ended up having to take, I think, 3 days off of shooting. Everyone went on vacation except for Jane and Mandy and Austin. And you know, 3 days to learn 6 numbers is also really not that much. And the way Mandy works is really amazing and collaborative, where she works with the actor. And so it's very, it's not like she comes up with the moves and she says, learn them. We sit there and we talk about what the character is going through. Why is this going to be a comedic number? I mean, I could talk about this for so long, but we have to pre-record the songs. Once the songs are pre-recorded, or if we have like a demo of somebody else singing it, we can start crafting the number. I would say most musical numbers get 2 to 5 rehearsals. 2 would be very little. And then I'm also in every number because the superpower comes from me. So I watch them, which is kind of why it's a little disappointing. Like this year, especially, I've been like, I really wish Zoe could partake in the numbers in new ways, because, you know, there's been a 90, we've shot 97 so far. Like, we need to advance her relationship with this thing. But it's hard because there's no time for me to go into the rehearsal room. So I always have to learn my movements on the day. So I can't really do anything that intricate. Anyways, it's a very time consuming job. Thank God. I mean, I have like limitless energy. I'm like somebody who's like bouncing off the walls. So it's a good fit right for me.
That actually brings up something I wanted to ask you, because I came across in another interview with you, I thought the guy had a good question, which is, I'm just going to quote it back. So Zoe is the only one who can see other people singing, so her reactions are crucial to the scene. How do you keep watching performances interesting? How do you make sure not to go too broad as she's listening, or go so soft that she seems detached, close quote. So, yeah, I mean, that's its own challenge, I guess.
Well, I have like a heady response, and I hope it doesn't sound too pretentious when I talk about my process, but I felt from the very beginning of this show that it, for us to really like believe that this is happening, something physical has to happen to Zoe. It's like, you know, when a superhero turns into the Hulk or whatever, like there's a physical transformation. And I felt like there has to be, and also it can't just be like, because like we haven't really gone into explaining what this power means or who it came from. But for me, Jane, I have like very specific ideas about that. And I think it was very much related to losing her father, getting this power. But, you know, I think that all these songs come from Zoe because it's from her brain. So I'm like, first of all, I'm very much affected by music, like we all are. So there's actual music playing when I'm reacting and something's happening to me. I'm watching, if it's not my co-star doing it, there's someone standing in doing the move. So I'm watching somebody experience something to this music. Usually it's my co-star's amazing singing voice. And for me, I always think about like, why would Zoe sing this song? You know, and I know she's not, they are. But this superpower obviously has to do with her path as a human being. And most of the time she's learning basically empathy, or like her empathetic muscle in her body is opening more, if there is that. So I guess I think of it as Zoe's like a projector. And she starts to have this like sensation that comes over her, like, oh, I'm going to hear a heart song. And what she's projecting is that musical number. So I feel like it's happening to Zoe also, you know?
Yeah, no, I love that. I think it's a great.
Again, I sound like a.
Makes sense. Okay. No, makes sense. So you mentioned your co-stars, and in season 1, that was Peter Gallagher as your dad, Mary Steenburgen as your mom, Lauren Graham as your boss, and I don't want to, again, if people are going to just start the show because they heard this, I don't want to give away too much. But I mean, you've talked about with Peter Gallagher, really, I guess, of the songs that you perform on the show, in season 1, the ones that you did with him were some of the really special ones to you. You mentioned True Colors, but there's also How Do I Live, which is a Diane Warren song. There's a one without music that you guys have. You know, so I'd be curious, anything you want to say about Peter, anything you want to say about Mary. But then Lauren was particularly interesting to me because here's somebody who has previously been at the center of her own big show, Gilmore Girls, and is now in a supporting role, almost like a surrogate mother in some ways to this character. And also, it sounds like, to Jane, right? So anyway, go off on those three if you feel like it.
Yeah, I mean, when I just heard you say it again, I was like, damn, I'm so lucky. I grew up watching The OC, and Sandy Cohen was like my generation's fantasy father. So like, I already had that like feeling about him where I've like always wished he was my dad, basically. And, you know, to me, my favorite part of the show is the connection between Zoe and her dad, because I think it's so universal. Duh. Like, we all, even if we don't have a dad or if we don't have parents in the traditional sense, we all know what it's like to want like parental comfort and affection and connection. And so I feel like that through line with the show made it really special. You know, like, a lot of people when the show was first coming out, they were like, oh, it's just another Glee, or it's just another network show trying to be a musical. But I think it's more than that. And people came to realize when they started watching the show. And what was really cool about these musical numbers with Peter is I'm an actor. Like, I wasn't a musical theater person. So I came to this really only knowing about acting. And, you know, at first I was like, oh, I gotta like learn how to sing and dance like my co-stars. And then I was like, no, I don't. I just want to be able to use that expression to like deepen my acting or like my performance to like, so with the musical numbers I did with Peter, I feel like we really nailed that combo where it's like using song and dance to tell the story, not just using song and dance to be able to sing really well or dance really well, which, by the way, I love watching, but to be able to do it in this way that is like feels like authentically happening in the moment. And it just is like a richer exploration of grief, you know, by using song and dance. Like, that is so cool. And Peter is such a great scene partner. I mean, I just had the paternal vibes from him. He's a great actor and he's a great person. And I felt like he cared about me. And those scenes were just, yeah, like scenes I think I'll never forget shooting. Mary is, I mean, a legend. And I just watched her in Happiest Season. And I was like, Mary, you're the funniest part of that movie. And also the fact that you can go from our show to that and Last Man on Earth. And like, she can do anything. And it's just also really inspiring to watch someone at her age be down to try something so new and vulnerable, like dancing and singing on camera. Like, that is radical. And then Lauren, Lauren and I were friends before because of Mae Whitman. We share a mutual best friend. Mae played Lauren's daughter on Parenthood. And I remember when we were shooting the pilot, there was a different actress cast as Joan, and great actress, wasn't quite right for the part. And I remember after we shot the pilot, there was talks about her being recast, and I was sitting at lunch with Lauren and I was like, I think you should play the part. And she was like, me? No, I can't play a mean boss. And also like, no. And then I remember she texted me that night and was like, I'm just like thinking about like sliding across desks doing a musical number. And I was like, Austin, Lauren Graham. And then it was like,
so you made that happen? I didn't know that.
I made it happen, but I did suggest it. And then it was like, can we get Lauren Graham? Like, you know. And anyway, she ended up doing it, which was like a wild treat on so many levels. People adore her for good reason. And she was so funny as Joan. Like, she really made that character. It was written as like a scary mean boss, and I think the way that she made that character like unhinged is so funny and like awkward, and like how she wants to be friends with Zoe, but like, I think we talked about this in our conversation, right, with Zach? I think anyways, and then yes, I was struggling last year because I was so tired and like my sleep was all messed up and my adrenal glands stopped working. And what are adrenal glands? I don't know. I just heard that those are something that help you have energy. But she would give me a lot of advice. And she really was there for me. And I am eternally grateful. And yeah, I mean, as people, as actors, we all know how amazing they are. And then as people, Mary, Peter, and Lauren are just really lovely.
Well, and I think part of the cool thing of the way that season ended with American Pie is to just see everyone come together in what is technically got to be just the most daunting thing, to basically have a one-er, like one continuous shot. Everybody's got to contribute their lines properly. I don't know how many takes you guys did, but it's worth whatever effort, you know. It just, I think it's terrific. One of the best moments of.
Yeah, it was really special. It wasn't actually a lot of takes. I mean, Mandy takes her job damn seriously. And by the time that we're shooting, she has rehearsed that like every which way. She has it down. Like this season, I'm like, wow, we shoot musical numbers so fast because she's like so prepared. American Pie was, yeah, so, so cool. Damn. Yeah.
Yeah. No, perfect. All right. So here we are. It's the last minute. I'm going to just sort of do five rapid fire, just big picture, what comes to your mind. Season two obviously started rolling out earlier this month. You guys made it during the pandemic, from what I understand. Why do you think the show, whether I think people even now are catching up, particularly with season one or recently, like during the pandemic, they have been catching up with it. Do you think there's something about people seeing it during the pandemic that makes them respond to it more than they otherwise would?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we had no idea when we were making the show season one about a girl grieving that it was going to come out when everybody was collectively grieving. You know, I think that also, one, we need new content. I mean, I do. I'm like, I've watched it all. And two, I think we want something that makes you feel uplifted, or like I said before, can make you laugh, cry, swoon, dance. Like, you know, it's a show full of heart and being there.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if season, again, without giving away plot in case there's people catching up, season one basically was, I don't know, I guess about dealing with the fear of something terrible happening. Season two, I think it would be fair to say, from what we've seen of it, is dealing with the aftermath of something happening. How would you synopsize, like compare and contrast the two experiences for you?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's that much of a spoiler to say that, you know, the whole first season is basically like warming up to say goodbye to someone, you know, and we say goodbye at the end of season one. And season two is, how do we move forward after a great loss?
Yeah. Did you find one season easier or harder? I mean, I guess the experience is going to have to have been so different based on the pandemic now as a factor for you guys.
Yeah. I mean, last year I was so tired and like all I wanted was a time to take a nap. And this year I'm like, I've been home for so long. All I want to do is go to work and distract myself. You know, I feel like so goddamn lucky to have this job right now. Many people are out of work. I'm so grateful to have a job. But two, it's like I just get to go do something with my brain all day long instead of look at the news and eat myself to death.
Yeah, it's pretty much. All right. So number three of five, the other thing during this pandemic, and we did talk about this before, but I mean, it's really kind of hard to stop thinking about, is that obviously theater is gone for now. Hopefully, you know, it's going to be a while, but like in the meantime, if you want to see musical theater, you're going to get it from Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. Do you think that that's factored into this, where, I mean, obviously there's a huge audience for this kind of stuff normally. It collectively, I mean, Broadway makes more money than all of the New York sports teams combined. Just that's one city in the country. So there are many people who can't be in New York for theater and musical theater who crave it. And so I guess just that aspect of it, that you guys are really the thing that's keeping it alive in a sense.
Man, I haven't thought about it like that. I don't have anything to say. that makes me feel honored and sad. And I really hope, I hope sooner rather than later, you know.
So that's number four, is that let's say Broadway comes back a year from now or whatever it is, hopefully sooner rather than later. Somebody calls you up now that they've seen you do Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. They know you can sing. They know you can dance. And they say, hey, it's your off season. We want you to come do a limited engagement, as they call it. That's where they get all the movie and TV stars to come in there for like 8 weeks and do something. Would you do a musical on Broadway?
Absolutely. I'd have a lot of work cut out for me. I mean, I'll tell you. I got to put on those dance shoes and go to those singing lessons, and I'd be very terrified, but I absolutely would do that.
Okay. People are listening. I know some of them are from the Broadway community. And then finally, this is now, the show debuted in what month of last year? The season one went on the air.
Well, January was episode one, and then episode two came out in February, and then continued from there. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's now been a year that people have been consuming this and getting to know you if they hadn't already seen, let's say, Suburgatory or something else. I mean, this has got to be your biggest audience yet. How has it, at the end of the day, and I know the pandemic again probably changes the answer from what it would have been, but how do you feel that being on this show has affected you personally, just being out in the world, when we could do that, and just the way people interact with you, and then professionally, do you find that it's already opened up other doors?
I feel like maybe professionally it is opening up more doors, and I'm grateful for that. It hasn't changed my personal life in any way. Like I don't really get recognized. Also, I wear masks. Also, I don't leave the house. But I mostly, like when you were just talking, I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Like there's something that starts happening in my chest where I'm just like, yeah, this show means so much to me. And this part means so much to me. And I wish I had like an eloquent way to like sum it up. But, it's like, it's a life-changing experience in so many ways that maybe I'll be able to talk about it better once it's over. But like right now I'm in the midst of it and just like, I really love it.
Well, can't thank you enough for this and for the show, which has been so fun. And now I feel like we're Twitter pals. I enjoy following your Twitter. And I just hope people will catch up on the show if they aren't already. And thank you again. Really appreciate
it. Yeah, I just want to say thank you, though. Like, your support really means a lot. And this was so lovely. And I'm happy to get to know you. And thank you.
We just want to note that The Hollywood Reporter offered Philip Noyce an opportunity to respond to the comments made by Jane Levy during this podcast, and he sent us the following statement. Quote, "While I don't recall the incident as Jane Levy described during costume selection for What If, I am deeply sorry for any pain or humiliation I caused her, and for that I sincerely apologize." Close quote. Thanks very much for tuning in to Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/the race. Until next time, thanks for joining us.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.